I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, welcome along to a brand new episode of Writer's Routine. This week we're chatting to Chioma Okereke. Her new novel, Water Baby, looks at a 19-year-old woman trying to escape her community. We talk about why she writes genreless to explore, and also what the purpose of her writing is. You can hear how she researched her location without actually going there for a little while, and what she does when she comes up against a creative block.
You just move slower. It's like the ink in your pen is just running slower. You just can't generate the thoughts, the propulsion. I'm not entirely sure what it is, but rather than push it, because I feel that to push it could lead to me becoming blocked again in a way that I choose not to be, I just give that day a pass and approach it the next day. But usually if anyone saw my first drafts, they would think I was a mad person if they didn't already assume that from my desk. Because there are lots of times where I don't even know what I'm doing, or I've just put in the mid-sentence, I've put an XXX, which means, you know, I kind of knew where that sentence was going, but I couldn't finish it enough and I'm still trying to do my 1,000 words, so I'll just leave that and fill it in later.
It's all on the way with Chioma Okereke in this week's Writer's Routine. Yes, welcome along to the show. This is Writer's Routine, where we take a look through an author's working day. My name's Dan Simpson. Our job around here is simple. Well, it sounds simple. We chat to the best writers on the planet. We try and see how they get stuff done. Where, when, how they plan to give them the best chance of getting words down on the page. And this week, we're with Chioma Okereke. She started her storytelling career as a performance poet. Her short story, Trompette de l'Amour, was a highly placed runner-up in the Costa Short Story Award. Then her debut, Bitter Leaf, was shortlisted for the Commonwealth Writers' Prize, and she's back with a novel called Water Baby. It explores the pressures of a 19-year-old woman trying to escape her community, her life, a place she grows up that's seemingly unescapable. It looks at themes of education, digitalisation, the representation of Africa. And it all came from her mind wandering while watching a cooking show. We talk about the germination of that idea and the research around it, and during her research of Makawoko, a floating community in Nigeria where the story is set. Whilst researching it, Chioma set up a new charity called Makoko Pearls, which is a direct and safe way to financially support the charity. It must be tough basing your novel in a place, in a community, which is so vital to the plot. It's at the heart of everything that goes on. But if you haven't really been there, how do you know enough about it from research online and in books to make that authentic and to have us as readers believe it? We discuss that. Also, you can hear about her busy, busy desk, about the move from short-form poems and fiction to long-form novels. You can hear what performance poetry taught her about novel writing, how picking up on an audience's reaction has influenced her choice of words on the page, and we run through why simply some days are just bad and what you do then. It's all on the way with Chioma Okereke, and we start off as we always do with what she sees around her in the place where she sits down to write.
I write in what has been dubbed at home as the writer's room, but it's the spare bedroom. which is what could only be described as perhaps egg carton or eggshell. Is that greyish? That was a bone of contention with me and my other half when I painted it this way. I painted it this color, but I find it very cocooning, quite nice. I have quite a large writer's desk that I found. I love going to flea markets and book hunting, so I have a wonderful writer's desk with red leather inlay, which is then surrounded by lots of desk tat. I have a lot of charge keys and all sorts of bits and bobs and gifts from people and all sorts of things that can perhaps stimulate the imagination on my desk. And behind me is a rather large chest filled with loads of books and a window. I've tried turning the desk the other way to look out the window, but I actually find that very distracting. And there is a minimal glimpse of the river, but it's not enough to entice. It actually makes it more distracting. So I sit with my back to the window, but which is fine because then the light kind of comes, creeps over the desk. And in front of me are an array of paintings, of sketches and all sorts of bits on the wall by the bed, by the guest bed.
It seems like there's a fine line between what's inspiring and what's distracting. You know, you can't look out the window because it's too distracting, but you can have a clutter-filled desk because that is inspirational. I find it nerdily intriguing what people have on their desk. Some people like it really sparse and clinical, whereas you like things, stuff, mementos.
Yeah, I definitely like a lot of things, and every day is a daily battle of those things falling off the desk. You know, they're distractions as well, but in a very different way. You know, I have a ton of post-it notes because I love to take notes and do scraps of paper, all sorts of things like that. But just random collection from travels and life and everything else, which is they're inanimate objects rather than actual the scrolling tapestry if you're looking out the window. So it's very easy for me to get distracted if I'm following a mother pushing a buggy over the bridge or a horse moving, you know, those kind of things are much more distracting than the comet relief monkey that's sat on my desk for the last 10 years.
So, like, what is that doing for you? Like, when you're looking at the comic relief monkey or anything else you might have, how is that igniting your imagination?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, first of all, it's keeping me company. It's quite an amusing looking monkey. But I also just think that there's a riot of colour on my desk. There's colour and there's textures and there are shapes. And I think all of those things help when you are in the midst of writing something. So I think that's probably why I have them around me. I'm not someone that can requires a complete blank desk and a blank page. That's just too much pressure. So I kind of like the fact that I have to sort of make room on the desk to write.
So there's a lot that's inspirational around you. Is there anything practical that reminds you what you're there to do? I'm thinking maybe post-it notes or notepads or maybe a big chart, a whiteboard that lets you know what's going on?
Yes, I have. Back in the day, I used to have a whiteboard. When I wrote my first novel, I had a massive whiteboard and I had the words write your way out scrawled on there, which was my daily challenge. I no longer have a whiteboard, but I do have, as I say, a ton of post-it notes and I have notebooks as well. And then I become very superstitious. And if I start writing in pencil, I won't, you know, make a note in a pen or I won't make a note in a particular color of pen, all those kind of things, which make absolutely no sense, but whatever works. So I do have a lot of, and again, I have lots of post-it notes that I don't throw away. So then I have a massive pile as you go along and you start making character notes and observations and things to remember. And there is no sense and there's no order. And that's equally a distraction when you have to go pick through those notes to find what you're looking for. But again, it all helps.
If I were to find one of your post-it notes, could I make head or tail of it? Is it written in a kind of strange language that only you understand?
Sometimes I think you could. Sometimes very clearly it might be a scrap of dialogue that I got on a walk. And so it would just be a random exchange, or it would be a name. Or, yeah, I think sometimes you would be able to understand, and other times it would be pure gibberish, because to me it is.
And you, well, you're all around the world, really. I know you split your time between London and Lagos and France, and I understand it would be very hard to perfectly create three separate writing spaces. But just if you are working from one country to the other, are there any similarities in what you find you do like around you when you are writing?
Not especially. I mean, that also sounds very glamorous, whereas I am, I do... As much as I flit, I am a nesting bird. So I've been in France for a very long period of time, and I'm only in Lagos now, just for a few weeks. So it depends on really what I'm working on. Like, if I'm fully invested in something and knee deep in something, I don't really need a particular place to work. And I don't need all that kind of stuff around me. I'm kind of not fussed. But if you're usually at the starting point, that's where you need a safe space and things that are familiar, and I need that kind of mood. So in terms of when I write in London or when I write in Nigeria and stuff, I'm pretty much hot desking. And so I wouldn't necessarily start something there. I didn't know if I would, maybe the thread of a thought, I would have to tease it a long time, but mostly when I was back in France, which is really my base.
Now, I chat to a lot of writers, and quite many of them are genre-based authors. So if you imagine a crime writer, like, they are writing because they've set themselves this puzzle, this mystery, which they want to solve. It strikes me, because of the nature of your work across what poetry and short stories and novels now, it's a bit harder to define and grasp. So I just thought I'd ask, What's the purpose of you writing? Like, why are you doing it? What is it doing for you?
I say, well, rather than my genre being crime or whatever you want to call it, then maybe my genre is the human condition. So I don't really necessarily think about it in those other terms. I just, I am an observer of life and of people, and that's what I write about. I don't think it really matters whether that is poetry or short stories or in longer form fiction in terms of my novels. And it's one of those things that's interesting to me as well, because I watch a lot of police procedurals and all that kind of stuff, crime stuff. I mean, I eat all of that up on TV, but that's not something that I think I have the skills to create. Otherwise, maybe I would write a crime novel or at least have a crack at it. I'm not entirely sure, but... I just write. I haven't really thought about it deeper than that.
Uh-huh. No, I like that analysis of it. And starting out as you did with performance poetry, I often hear that writers enjoy reading their work aloud because it helps them get a more unique sense on what it is. And I wonder if you starting out performing poetry, there's a degree to which you're kind of backfilling. Like, how much has that influenced the way that you now write novels, would you say?
Well, I hated reading my stuff out loud. I was probably the worst performance poet that ever lived. We hated it. It reminded me of when I used to run, and I would get really nervous before a race, but I was a very good runner and usually won. But the abject terror and fear beforehand kind of really overshadowed anything that came, even the win, the success, the record breaking or whatever it is. And that was the same thing with performance poetry. I felt that I was good at it. I really enjoyed my poems. But when you get on stage and you've got this microphone and you start talking and suddenly it goes really silent, I would get so terrified. And I imagined I just looked really crazy on the stage. And so I found that really, really uncomfortable. But I remember after one performance, someone said to me, actually, you should be quite flattered by that because it actually means that people are listening. And I don't know if that actually terrified me more. But I found myself slowly retreating more and more to the page until I stopped performing altogether. And so I think I found a safety in actually writing things that I wasn't going to perform. And then when I discovered sort of prose and started writing my first novel, there was a safety there because I feel like I was just amusing myself. You know, I was just writing a story for myself. And again, I couldn't ever imagine reading a whole novel out loud to anyone or doing that kind of thing. So it was then after I published my first novel that I thought, oh, I may actually have to do some readings. And what cracked the reading for me was that there was a brief point in time where I was actually seeing a therapist, and which I found really interesting, having to go into a room and sort of unload your deepest, whatever, darkest confessions and bits and bobs. And I suddenly thought, after about my third session with this therapist, I thought, how can I do this, but I can't stand on a stage and read a book that I've written, which is a completely different setting where everybody's rooting for you and you've already written all the words, so you know what you have to say, as opposed to revealing the, you know, the most intimate parts of yourself. And that was the thing that actually cracked my stage fright. So I thought, well, if I can do that, I can surely go read from my book. And so it's much less of a challenge for me now to do any of those kind of things.
Do you learn from, well, nowadays, live readings, back in the day, performance poetry? Do you learn a lot about, because you've got an audience there, so you've got live reaction, do you learn about what's working, what doesn't, how to tell a story efficiently and quickly?
I don't know, because sometimes, you know, so some of my favorite performance poets weren't the ones that were doing all the bells and whistles, and that's sometimes what a crowd resonates, you know, that resonates more with the crowd. I think there's some people that are just very, very charismatic on stage and they can, you know, take you along with them, and that's part of your performance. But I think I'm probably poet first, performance second. So in that sense, I wasn't necessarily relearning, and I think that my poetry equally was poetry first, performance second. And so you can't really necessarily get cues as to what people are really feeling necessarily. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, yeah. And just thinking back to that history, it's a unique place to start putting down words, really. I mean, there's the phrase that everyone's got a book in them, right? And I think a lot of people, when they decide they want to write, they will just try that novel. Yeah, you started writing poetry. So what do you remember about the moment that you thought, and you've kind of discussed this a second ago, but what do you remember about that decision to think, okay, I think I've got something longer in me, something that I can sustain over 300 odd pages?
Well, actually, Bitterleaf, which was my debut, had actually started out as what I thought was going to be a collection of poems about the two main protagonists in the book. And I thought, I'll actually have a collection of poetry, but I would also have this these poems speaking to each other, and see if anyone could see if they were connected. So it actually started out as a kind of loose connections of poems. But I remember back in the day that I'd gone to a dinner party, and I was sat next to the owner of Express Books at the time, like the black-owned book publishing house, and he was talking about poetry and prose, and sort of said to me, oh, just come back when you've written a novel or whatever it is. I can't do anything with poetry. Come back with when you've written a novel. And I said, you know, I'll never write a novel. I'm talking about poetry is all about the possibility of language. And, you know, I spent this whole dinner trying to sell him on that whole thing and thinking I'm never going to write anything long form. And then I went back to my computer, like maybe a few days or weeks later, and this thing just started happening that I couldn't explain. And so this collection of poems, a poem literally stopped appearing in a kind of poem form, rhyming form, and then just moved into a sentence and a paragraph and a page, and that's what happened. And so that's why I sort of kept that at the beginning of my debut. It starts off with a poem and just kind of feeds into the novel, and that's what happened.
How much do you have to think about that consciously when the change is happening? How much do you have to sit there and think, oh, I'm in a novel now, how a novel's written, how does this need to read that perhaps a poem doesn't?
That's a really good question. I don't know if I have the answer for that. I'm not sure, because particularly in the last few years, I've really occupied the space of a novelist. I've probably written two poems. It's really funny how when that sort of novelist voice appeared, it kind of overtook everything. It's like learning another language and, you know, pushes out the one you have before. That's effectively what happened. But I also think that there is a comfort in being long-winded, whereas with a novel where, sorry, with a poem, where every word is almost curated, there's probably an ease that I leaned into. And so I just became more accustomed to writing novels. So I'm not really consciously thinking now, oh, what is coming and what is it going to be? I think I am just creating. And it is what it is. It's like, wait, I don't know if I sound like some pretentious sculptor or something, or something, you know, with a piece of clay, and they say that, you know, the clay knows already what it is, but it's a little bit like that.
And there's a massive benefit to having started out writing poetry. You said, you know, almost every word has to earn its place. And that's a really good mindset to go into novel writing with, because there's nothing worse than reading something where you know, as a reader, that this could be cut down by at least a third. Have you felt the benefit of moving from poetry in just the way that you're structuring sentences and the words you're using?
I don't know, because I don't know any other way. So that's the only way I know how to do it. I don't think there's necessarily a benefit. I actually don't know about that, because I was probably more substantially a page poet, that I can get sometimes occasionally stuck in the way things need to appear in a way that you shouldn't necessarily concern yourself with when you are just trying to write, but particularly when you're trying to, at least your first draft and bits and bobs, trying to just get words down on paper. So I don't know. Yeah.
What do you mean by the way it needs to appear?
When you are sort of bogged down on an unnecessary detail, a description of thing or something, and looking for that most perfect word or most perfect phrasing or framing, which I don't think you... Obviously, when you write your first draft and you go and you edit and you polish and stuff in terms of a novel, then that's great. You can go and craft on that. But sometimes, particularly in when writing poetry and stuff, I mean, you can spend ages on a line, you know, and in that sort of sense. So sometimes I do get tripped up by that, where I am just trying to write freely, but my poetry brain kicks in, and then I'm stuck on a particular thing. And a part of me appreciates that it's not the right time to be tripped up and focused on this thing, but I have to solve whatever this little tiny thing is, even if it's a description or an aesthetic I'm trying to get or something, as opposed to just, you know, in that same amount of brain time, banging out 2,000 words. I'm an early riser, but I mean, not ridiculously early. I might wake up early, but I probably spend too much time on my phone and my device. But I tend to write in the morning. And for me, it's about getting down whatever it is. I do like 1,000 words a day. That's usually my thing, because I think that's it's very achievable. And then you also don't feel that sense of failure. So I try and get my 1,000 words a day done as early as possible. And then I usually follow that up with a walk. I live in the countryside, which is quite nice. And so you can go on a long walk that tends to shake things loose, usually from the day's writing. Thoughts and comments and, you know, all those kind of things. And so probably on that walk, I will stop 1,000 times and leave voice notes or, you know, write some things in my phone. And then I go back in the afternoon. And if I'm feeling particularly inspired, I might try and push my word count. Sometimes I might look at what I've written, try and edit. I really trying to stay away from editing while I'm writing the stuff, but you can't help it. It's just like, you know, it's there and you want to tweak some of the stuff you've done before, but that's usually what I do. But I try and cheat the work out if I can, but I'm not really that bothered about it.
So that's pretty tight then. I know that you are busy with other stuff. There's the charity that you've recently set up. How are you finding, I guess, keeping to your early mornings and finding other spaces in the day to do different bits while making sure creatively your head is still in the zone of your story?
Well, it's become more of a struggle, but I think that's also the beauty of at least trying to keep the mornings for writing, because if you try and bank that time at the end of the day, it's just not going to happen. There is far too much going on at the moment. As you say, I set up a charity recently and perhaps naively, and didn't think about the amount of paperwork and work and emails and everything else, not to mention, the day job as well. So I try and at least keep that morning hour mind, so at least I can get some stuff down on paper. And particularly at the moment now, while I'm writing a handful of short stories and stuff, which is also easier as well, because if I was writing another book now, I think it would be absolutely impossible, so close to the release of Water Baby and with all the sort of commitments on your time. But I think by concentrating on shorts and sort of little articles, I'm still keeping my creative juices flowing and feeling that I'm in that state of creation, which is also good, because I find it very difficult when you drop off or you have a couple of years where you're not writing. I find that particularly difficult. But if I'm in that sort of constant state of creation, then I feel like when the time is ready, I could start something new.
And you mentioned the 1,000 word goal. How perfect do they need to be? How much is the poetry side of your brain kicking in at times to try and make these the best, because you don't want to edit for ages?
Well, sometimes it's less than perfect, and sometimes you don't make that 1,000. But I think the key is just to at least to have that intention. If I woke up and just said, I'm just going to write today, then most likely I would have 200 words down, because that poetry brain would kick in. But if I know, okay, listen, I have to get to 1,000, just that little bit of a challenge is very motivational for me. And so I think that really does work. It doesn't have to be great. Sometimes I know that I'm really, really struggling, and those are the days that I'm like, you know what, it's 700, that's the best it's going to be. But it's not just to have 1,000 words and where you are just, you know, retyping gibberish. That's utterly, you know, at the end of the day, that's pointless. But usually you can get close to something that you will then also want to use, as opposed to scrapping it the following day or scrapping it when you're in your editing stage.
What do you think's happening when there is a bad day, when you are stuck at 700? Have you ever tried to reason why some days you can kind of crack out 1,500 and other times you're really struggling to make the 1,000 goal?
That's a really good question. I have no idea really about that. The funny thing is I did my one and only writer's program in like 2004 with Percival Everett at Texas A&M University. And I remember there after sometime during that program, he said to me, oh, there's no such thing as writer's block. And I was like, oh, Percival says there's no such thing as writer's block. And then I came back to the UK and I didn't write for ages. And I was like, oh my God, I am the definition of a writer's block. But, you know, these days I do understand what he's saying, because there really isn't a block. You can just pivot and write, you know, do something else. You can, and so now sometimes when I get trapped, I just, you know, literally leave a blank in my document and then just start writing something else, or, you know, writing a completely different section or something like that. So there is movement, there is, you know, a way forward. But like I say, having said that, there are just some days where, I don't know, you just move slower. It's like the ink in your pen is just running slower. You just can't generate the thoughts, the propulsion. I'm not entirely sure what it is, but rather than push it, because I feel that to push it could lead to me becoming blocked again in a way that I choose not to be, I just give that day a pass and approach it the next day. But usually if anyone saw my first drafts, they would think I was a mad person if they didn't already assume that from my desk. Because there are lots of times where I don't even know what I'm doing, or I've just put in the mid-sentence, I've put an XXX, which means, you know, I kind of knew where that sentence was going, but I couldn't finish it enough and I'm still trying to do my 1,000 words. So I'll just leave that and fill it in later. And then, you know, keep going and writing, and then there'll be a why, because I haven't, you know, given that character a name yet, and, you know, and move on. So it does look like, you know, I don't know, it does look nuts, but it does make sense to me eventually, or I just have to scrap some parts of it.
Because your writing is a lot more, well, observational, as you say, it's it's about exploring rather than, you know, as we said, more genre-based writing where you are working to a fixed kind of point that we expect. Does that mean your timeline of when you can expect to be done is a lot harder to figure out?
Yes and no, because you see, when I wrote my debut, like I said, I had the heart and the mind of a poet, and so I wrote when the muse struck me. You know, I belabored over sections of it. I kind of see all my attempts in that first thing. It's a very good indicator of where I was as a writer at that time, and it's one of those things where, you know, I cringe when I look at it now, but I can see my progression from then and now. And so I knew that when I was going to put my feet back in the ring, I don't even know what the expression is, that I was going to approach it very differently. So, and also any writer knows that it takes time to craft a novel, but it also takes time to find an agent and to get a publisher and all those kind of things. And I thought, I can't spend years trying to do this as well and then get a rejection, and you've spent all that time crafting a novel and you get a rejection, you have to start again. So I thought, okay, let me think strategically. Well, what if I can bang out a novel quickly and then try and get an agent and try and get a publisher, and then you haven't spent that much time, and that's, you know, so that's what it is. And so what is a novel? Well, essentially 80 or 90,000 words. And if you can write 1,000 words a day, then what's that? Then you've got a novel in like 3 months, give or take. Let's see how possible that is. And so that was actually what I did in 2019 as a test for myself. And I managed to bang something out, and it got me an agent. And I was like, oh, well, that's interesting. Let's see if I can replicate it again. So that is the sort of new model with which I've been working, in the hopes that even if you ultimately don't do it in 3, you're likely to do it in 6. And so, you know, that's much better than sort of giving yourself that it's done when it's done. And 4 or 5 years later, I could still be crafting on something that would ultimately yield no reward when it actually goes out in the market.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You can hear more from Sherry Mate in just a second. Very quickly, if you're enjoying the show, if you've learned anything along the way that has helped the way that you tell your stories, if something we have brought you in over 300 episodes has just slightly tweaked the way that you write, well, you can say thank you to that, I guess, by becoming a Patreon and pledging to support the show on our Patreon page, patreon.com/writersroutine. I think you become a patron anyway. For that, you get merch. There is bonus content. There is even a way for your book to sponsor this show. So if you like what we do, if you would like to see this carry on, for me to keep bringing you these chats with the best authors around as often as I can. And remember, it's just me. It's just me that does all this. So any help that you can kind of send my way, it really goes a long way. And I promise, I absolutely appreciate any cent or penny that gets sent over. It doesn't require a lot, just a few dollars a month. It helps me out. And for that, so much waiting for you over on our Patreon page. Become part of a writing community that we've got. Check out book reviews, recommendations. There's loads going on just for a few dollars a month. And you get this show for free as always. And I would love to see you be a part of it over at patreon.com/writersroutine. Let's get back to it with Chioma Okereke then chatting through her new novel Water Baby. It comes off the back of debut success with Bitter Leaf, which was shortlisted for the Commonwealth Writers Prize. She's had short story success too, and a grounding as a performance poet, as we heard, a performance poet who hated performing poetry. We chat about how she researched her location. I mean, setting a story in a place a little while away whilst trying to capture its essence must have been quite tough to do without directly going there for a little while. So hear what she did to bring it to life. Also, we run through how her life of living in different places and traveling the world has influenced her ability to tell stories, what the purpose of them is, why it's to explore, to investigate, and why traveling is so important for that. And we get back to it talking about how switching around her plotting method helped her when writing this new second novel.
Extremely helpful to me. And I think it just, again, I didn't have the pressures that you just spoke about, in terms of there wasn't a set, you know, there wasn't, I wasn't under contract, it was a complete free bird. So it was actually just me prioritizing my time and using my time wisely. And so I thought, let me approach it in a completely different way and see if that works out, as opposed to, and you know, sometimes when you're so passionate about something and you care so much about something, and it kind of, it hurts worse, obviously, than you know, your books are your babies and you take them out there and someone tells you your baby's ugly, your baby's not going to go to preschool or whatever it is. Whereas I was like, okay, well, if I, you know, again, it doesn't mean that I don't like my work, but if I work in a completely different way, then it's a, what's the word? It's, you know, stop loss, or it's a short, sharp fail, if that's the case. And that's what I was doing. But then it becomes actually very, very interesting, because when you're writing at that speed, like when I read things back, I don't remember writing them. Whereas with the debut, I almost remember it frame by frame, because it was such a craft. It was such a creation of mine. Whereas even now, when I look at the proof of Water Baby, there are chapters in there. I have no recollection of writing that at all.
And moving on to any future novel that you're writing, how much are you keen to mix up the way you did it for Water Baby?
I think I would probably stick with it, because I think it's been very good for actually motivating me to write swiftly, and with that to generate ideas and not languish, because it's also really difficult sometimes when you are writing a book. You know, you start out, for me, once I hit that 10,000 word mark, I know that I can potentially keep going. That the first 10,000 is usually the hardest, 10,000 to 30,000. And then when I hit 30,000, I know that I can continue and I can finish this. But what I try and do is not look at the, I get to the 10,000, but between 10 and 30, I try not to look at the word count, which I know doesn't make sense if I say I'm doing 10,000 words a day. Sorry, words a day.
I was going to ask, if you're not looking at the word count, how do you know you've hit 30,000 words?
But in that sort of way, you kind of know what you're doing. So you know, and you know what it looks like on the page as well. So you know you've kind of done your three pages or whatever it is. So I try not to really think about it too much. And then if I go beyond 1,000, I don't really count what those beyond the thousands were. You know what I mean? So I know that it's totting up nicely. And so it's a pleasant surprise when you suddenly look up and you're at, you know, 34,000 or 37 or something. And then I'm like, okay, well, fine, this is sustainable and I can actually turn this into, this is going to be a novel. This isn't just going to run out of steam and I've, you know.
We get quite niche and nerdy. Just one last question about your day. What software do you write on and what font do you write with?
Oh, question. Well, I was a big, I have a Mac now, so I feel like I've grown up, because beforehand I had a PC, which was again, what's the word, many arguments about my clunky PC and all its viruses. So eventually I moved to a Mac, and you know what, it's fine. The keyboard is really small, which is actually quite irritating to me because I don't need like an external keyboard, and I've got rather big hands and fingers, but you make do. And I write in all sorts of fonts because I start out with something, but if, again, one of the, you, when you said one, what happens, you know, some of the times that you can't get to the 1,000 words, you get stalled at 700, sometimes it's about the font. And so if I'm feeling particularly stuck, I will just change my font. And I find that even that is enough to get me writing again. So at the moment, I'm kind of enjoying Spectrum. But usually anything Georgia, Cambria, Calibri, Arial, you know, all of those are interchangeable to me.
Yeah, those are the classics. Yeah, yeah, we're on board with that. A bit of Georgia, quite stately, I find. Listen.
Yeah, I don't usually end up sustaining in Georgia, but, you know, it's you always like, you know, you like to try.
Yeah, it makes you feel fancy for a bit. I get that, I get that. It's interesting earlier you said that if yours were a genre, it would kind of be exploring the human condition. And it strikes me that although it's not as, you know, you mentioned that it's not as kind of glamorous as maybe it might read, but you do have time in France and you're in Lagos now and you've been in London, and that would make someone think that you have a much keener way of observing the human condition than other people, simply because you've seen a much wider range of humans, because you've been out and you've travelled. How much do you think that travel has affected your ability to explore and make stories about it?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I think that I was actually talking to some people about this yesterday, which is a group of young girls at the community centre in Makoko, which is where my book is set, in the largest floating slum in the world. So I'd gone to meet some schoolgirls yesterday, and I was talking about the fact that I was born in Nigeria, but then about at 6 or 7, I went to boarding school in the UK, and I at that time. There was just, luckily for me, my brother was in the same school as me in those early days, but I was the only black girl in the first school I went to, and I think I was probably the youngest boarder as well. And so I've always felt like an outsider, and had to learn quite early how to sort of shape shift and assimilate and, you know, sort of look like my peers or act like my peers if I couldn't look like my peers. So I've been observing for a very long period of time. And I think that that is what has informed the way I look at the world. I found the school library very, very early, and I was very excited to equally, amongst those bookshelves, find other people that looked like me and sounded like me and everything else. But I read voraciously and rather widely. But I think that, I think that having navigated many spaces and different countries allows you to ingest so much more data, first and foremost, but allows you just to see a wider tapestry of characters. You have just much more exposure to different things and tastes and sounds, and all that stuff feeds back into the writing. It popped into my head during the pandemic. Another book of mine was out of submission at the time, and I just had a confusing rejection. And I thought, fair enough, I'm just going to go make some dinner and find something to watch while eating my feelings. And our algorithm throughout the pandemic was predominantly food related. And so there was an episode of the best ever food show, something like that. And it was an episode shot in Makoko. And I watched this thing and I was completely blown away, because before that I kind of knew about the community, but I would only see it when I was crossing the bridge to come from the mainland to my father's house in Lagos. And half the time, you know, you can't see out the Lagos smog, or you're on you've got your face in your phone. You're not really paying attention. And I watched this chef sort of navigating the waterways, who's either going from, you know, canoe to canoe and hut to hut in search of food. And I just thought, why on earth have I never done that in my own country? And so we were watching this show, and my mind had wandered, as I don't know, the cooking food or something like that. But my mind wandered, and I just got this image in my mind of a girl. and she was piloting a canoe, and I could see her face, and I could see her arms, and I could see her clothes. Just got her so clearly, and I just knew things about her. And I said to my partner, I bet you if I wrote a story about, you know, a girl growing up here, you know, that would be published in, like, in a heartbeat. And he said, well, why don't you? And I thought, well, okay, fine, let me go and do it. And so I started doing some research about the community and just learning a bit more about it, because I knew nothing, and it was just such a fascinating and atmospheric place in and of itself. I mean, it's, like I said, it's the largest floating slum in the world. It was established in the 19th century when fishermen from Togo and the Republic of Benin sort of settled on the Lagos Lagoon. And it's often referred to as the Venice of Africa. But, you know, just one quick Google search will tell you it's nothing like that. There is water, and they have made homes, like wooden shacks on stilts above the Lagos Lagoon. But, you know, the water is the black of night. It is filled with trash and dirt, and it is... appalling conditions that the community lives in. It was such a compelling place, setting for me. And like I say, I saw baby so vividly in my brain that I just knew I had to write about it. But I would go to my computer and I would think, what now? And then, like, okay, I'm done enough research. And I would go back and do more research. And I would go back to the blank page and think, what now? And it took me just a little while to realize that actually the what now wasn't me. It was baby asking that question. Hers, it was her what now. And that's when I began to write the story.
The novel that you had put out on submission and, well, it was rejected then. Did that, what became of that?
I haven't done much with that actually. And it was also, it had just gone out on submission. So we'd only sent it to a couple of publishers, but then I just put a pause on that. Especially as it's really strange when you're getting submissions that aren't, I absolutely hated this and this goes nowhere. It's almost a bit confusing where people tell you, we really enjoyed it and we loved it and read it, but it's a no. And so I just had a feeling that maybe it wasn't fully cooked yet, and said that we shouldn't keep putting it out in submission. So that's been parked.
How tough is it to separate the two? So when you've got a novel that you've put a lot of time into, but you've got to park that and write something new, how tough is it to stop ideas and themes from the first, just kind of forcing and creeping their way into what you're working on afterwards?
It's tough, but it's not impossible. The novel that had been out on submission was set in France, and it was a completely different environment. So from that circumstances, it was actually very easy. When you're writing about Nigeria, writing about Lagos, it's completely different. And equally, when I was writing from baby's point of view, it's completely different language. Completely different visuals, all those kind of things. So it was very, it was easy in that term, English. But I think if I decided to write another book set in like the countryside in France, then things would probably creep in and it would be harder to disassociate. But I also just think that actually, for me, by the time you've come to the end of what you consider to be your novel, it is easy to let go. There will be things that you'll always want to tighten the sentence and craft this and trim that and whatever it is. But for the most part, it's kind of done. And that those voices recede into the background. And if you're lucky enough, you know, new voices appear. But it's not something that I am constantly thinking about, an old character. That doesn't really happen for me, thankfully.
So not the characters or the plot, but... And I don't want to labour this point too much, and this become a thing that I kind of prod you about, because I do want to move on and touch more on the story. But it just strikes me, because they did happen back to back quite quickly. Is there at all some kind of bitterness or some like thinking about, well, that didn't go out. What can I do differently? How can I make sure this does get published?
I don't think. I mean, for me, it was more. What was more interesting was the fact that the one that was written from what I think is a stronger place of knowledge is the one that was rejected versus me imagining what life is like in an informal settlement. that I hadn't stepped into until after I had, you know, submitted my first draft. So for me, there is a curiosity about that and about why my stories about Africa or my stories from that perspective seem to be the ones that catch the eyes of publishers. But, you know, equally, I just want to tell a good and compelling story. And so as an author, you're excited when, you know, a publisher or an agent or anybody, you know, resonates with your story.
And you mentioned research, and you hadn't actually set foot in Makoko until you had published this, right? So how tricky is it to research this place you've never been and try and not make it dry, that you're just interweaving in your plot a lot of facts verbatim about this place?
Yeah, I mean, that's the challenge, I think, but the luckily, like, again, I am a voracious reader and I watch a lot of things anyway, so I think just life feeds into your brain. I did a lot of research on the internet and it was fascinating to me, so poring over, you know, Guardian articles, climate change articles, trying to find any video I can find, like the cookery shows, and just luckily for me, there have been quite more and more footage emerging of the community and lots of drone footage, so you were able to sort of see, but it was still really quite difficult to see inside an individual hut and to really get that sense of what life is like on the water. So a lot of it was the power of my imagination. And just pouring through as many articles as possible. It was fascinating to me the first time I actually did go into the community, because I was literally watching things I'd written in the book taking place in real life. And so I was actually really quite pleased and relieved that I had captured it quite accurately, because that was my biggest fear about writing outside of one's your own experience and writing about such a community, to make sure that I did it respectfully. And it was a real relief. And so after that as well, a friend of mine had shot part of a film in Makoko, and so she sent me some of their recce footage as well, which was perfect because they had shot inside people's homes, and so I had even more knowledge of what things look like. And it was really exciting.
You mentioned doing it respectfully. Now, although you hadn't been to Makoko, you have been to Lagos, right? So
yeah.
How important is it for you not just to be respectful, but to be authentic and to present a side of West Africa that maybe we don't hear about in like Western media, because we only tend to hear about these things when stuff is going wrong?
Well, that's exactly right. I think that was, for me, was the greatest importance was to be authentic. Like I said, I was born in Nigeria and I'm very much connected to that part of my heritage. But essentially I am British, for want of a better term. And I don't think if I'm walking through Lagos that people consider me, you know, to be Nigerian. And so writing from that place as well was quite scary. And like, you know, will this resonate with my Nigerian readers as well? Will it feel like I've actually captured this place properly? And also dealing with such a sensitive subject, but trying not to use the tried and tested tropes, which is just inevitably when, you know, that always seems to happen with African fiction. So, you know, I was writing about an informal settlement, but it is equally baby's home. And so not necessarily pointing at the things that one would expect you to point at, and, you know, was the challenge, while also causing people to think about real issues of actually inhabiting an area with, you know, lack of access to basic social amenities, no electricity, you know, schools or healthcare, no clean water, what the reality of that is like. But equally, when that is your reality and you don't know any different, and you are making the best of your life and it is your home and where you come from and you love it.
So you go into writing this novel knowing that you want to write about this girl who is in this place. How much are you seeing the bigger picture of the story before you sit down and type the first sentence? How much do you know about the beginning, the middle, the end, the themes that you want to explore during this story, all coming from this one person that you've imagined while watching a cooking show?
I didn't know anything, actually, and I don't usually know anything. I think that one character leads to another character, and so sometimes you get a framing and then you sort of understand where Baby sits within her house and her household and her what now question. So I kind of knew where she was, and, you know, it was going to be a coming of age tale as she was sort of, you know, asking questions about her purpose and her place in the world and what she wants to do. And so that was the thread pulling the story forward. But in terms of having a beginning, a middle, and an end, I didn't really have any of that. It was just as certain things presented themselves as I was writing the book, in terms of, researching the book, in terms of I stumbled upon this drone mapping initiative that had taken place in the community to give young girls some tech skills, but also the idea of mapping the waterways, giving them more legitimacy in the eyes of the world and making it less likely for the government to try and push them away from what is considered prime waterfront real estate. And I imagined it that it was just the kind of thing that she would love to do. And that was, you know, again, a thread of the story, and she wanted to do it, but her father doesn't want her to do it for reasons the book will go into and all these kind of things. And so there was a natural progression from her having taken place in this thing and what comes as a result of that, that carried the story in a certain direction. So I was actually just very grateful for that. But largely, I don't know where I'm going. I'm just led.
Thank you so much to Chioma Okereke for coming on the show. The new book is Water Baby. You can get a copy right now. Thank you so much for listening to the show. Back next week with a brand new episode. In the meantime, you can support us over at patreon.com/writersroutine. While you're there, get merch, get bonus content, so much to be getting on with. You can also drop us a follow on X. We are at writerspod there. We're on TikTok as well if you'd like some book talk recommendations. If you find it easier to listen to episodes on YouTube, we've got stuff over there too. Just search Writers Routine Podcast. We will come up. You can get in contact using the page at writersroutine.com. And I will see you next week with a brand new guest on the show. Until then, thanks for listening. Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.